is our friend backing away from the door as if preparing itself. Elsa grows aware of someone standing behind her as if a ghost has appeared behind her. Or a,
"Look out!" growls the voice.
Elsa throws herself against the wall as the monster, silently, sweeps past with a key in his hand. In the next moment she is caught halfway between the monster and our friend, and this really is the biggest damned worse and biggest damned monster Elsa has ever seen. It feels as if someone is standing on her lungs. She wants to scream, but nothing comes out. Everything goes terribly fast after that. They hear the door opening at the bottom of the stairs, the voices of the police, and someone else who Elsa realizes must be animal control. Looking back, Elsa is not completely convinced that she's in control of her own movements. If she's been placed under a spell or something, it wouldn't be so unlikely, considering that even if it was unlikely, it would be far less unlikely than running into a flipping worse. But when the door closes behind her, she's standing in the hall, in the monster's flat. It smells of soap. Chapter 10. Alcohol. The sound of splintering wood fills the stairwell as the police drive the crowbar into the doorframe. Elsa stands in the hall, in the monster's flat, and watches them through the spy hole. Technically, her feet aren't touching the floor, though, because the worse has sat down on the hall mat so that she's wedged between the rear end of the enormous animal and the inside of the door. The worse looks extremely irritated. Not threatening, just irritated. As if there's a wasp in its bottle of lemonade. It occurs to Elsa that she's more panicked by the police on the other side of the door than the two creatures in the hall with her. Maybe it doesn't seem so very rational, but she's decided to trust more in Granny's friends than Britt Marie's. She rotates carefully by the door until she's facing the worse, then whispers in the secret language.
"You mustn't bark now. Please be good, or they'll kill you."
The worse doesn't look entirely convinced that it would come off worse if she opened the door and let it out among the police, and turns away dismissively. It stays silent, though seemingly more for Elsa's sake than its own. Outside on the landing, the police have almost forced the door open. Elsa hears them yelling command words at each other about being ready. She looks around the hall and into the living room. It's a very small flat, but the tidiest one of any description she has ever set foot in. There is hardly any furniture, and the few items that there are have been arranged face to face, looking as if they'll commit furniture harakiri if a single speck of dust lands on them. Elsa knows that because she had a samurai phase about a year ago. The monster disappears into the bathroom. The tap runs in there for a long time before he comes out again. He dries his hands elaborately on a small white towel, which he then folds neatly and goes to put in a laundry basket. He has to stoop to fit through the doorway. Elsa feels as Odysseus must have felt when he was with that giant Polyphemus, because Elsa recently read about Odysseus. Apart from the fact that Polyphemus probably didn't wash his hands as carefully as the monster. And apart from Elsa thinking she's not as high and mighty and self-righteous as Odysseus seems to be in the books. Obviously, but apart from that, sort of like Odysseus. The monster looks at her. He doesn't look angry. More confused, actually. Almost startled. Maybe that's what gives Elsa the courage to blurt right out,
"Why did my granny send you a letter?"
She says it in normal language, because for reasons not yet entirely clear to her, she doesn't want to talk to him in the secret language. The monster's eyebrows sink under his black hair so that it's difficult to make out any facial expressions at all behind it, and the beard and the scar. He's barefoot, but wears those blue plastic shoe covers you get at the swimming pool. His boots are neatly placed just inside the door, very precisely in line with the edge of the doormat. He hands Elsa another two blue plastic bags, but jerks back his hand once she touches them, as if worried that Elsa might also touch him. Elsa bends down and puts the plastic bags over her muddy shoes. She notices that she has slightly stepped off the mat and left two halves of her footprints in melted snow on the parquet floor. The monster bends down with impressive fluidity and starts wiping the floor with a fresh white towel. When he has finished, he sprays the area with a small bottle of a cleaning agent that makes Elsa's eyes smart, and wipes it with another small white towel. Then he stands up and neatly puts the towels in the laundry basket and places the spray bottle very exactly on a shelf. Then he stands for a very long time and stares uncomfortably at the worse. It lies splayed across the hall, covering the floor almost in its entirety. The monster looks like he's about to hyperventilate. He disappears into the bathroom and comes back and starts carefully arranging towels in a tight ring around the worse, while taking extreme care not to touch any part of it. Then he goes back to the bathroom and scrubs his hands so hard under the tap that the basin vibrates. When he comes back, he's got a little bottle of antibacterial alcohol. Elsa recognizes it because she had to rub that sort of stuff into her hands every time she was visiting Granny at the hospital. She peers into the bathroom through the gap under the monster's armpit when he reaches out. There are more bottles of alcohol in there than she could imagine there would be in Mum's entire hospital. The monster looks infinitely vexed. He puts down the bottle and smears his fingers with alcohol as if they were covered in a layer of extra skin which he had to try and rub off. Then he demonstratively holds up his two palms, each the size of a flatbed truck, and nods firmly at Elsa. Elsa holds up her own palms, which are more tennis ball-sized. He pours alcohol on them and does his best not to look too disgusted. She quickly rubs the alcohol into her skin and wipes off the excess on her trouser legs. The monster looks a little as if he's about to roll himself up in a rug and start yelling and crying. To compensate, he pours more alcohol on his own hands and rubs. Then he notices that Elsa has knocked one of his boots out of position in relation to the other. He bends down and adjusts the boot, then more alcohol. Elsa tilts her head and looks at him.
"Do you have compulsive thoughts?" says Elsa.
The monster doesn't answer, only rubs his hands together as if trying to get a fire started.
"I've read about it on Wikipedia."
The monster's chest heaves up and down, taking frustrated breaths. He disappears into the bathroom and she hears the sound of gushing water again.
"My dad is sort of slightly compulsive as well," Elsa calls out behind him, adding quickly, "But God, not like you. You're properly balmy."
Only afterwards does she realize it sounded like an insult. That was not at all how she meant it. She just didn't mean to compare Dad's amateurish compulsive behaviour with the monster's obviously professional obsessions. The monster returns to see the worse nibbling at her backpack, where it clearly believes there are some dime bars. The monster looks as if he's trying to go to a happier place inside his head. And there they stand, all three of them, a worse, a child, and a monster with a need for cleanliness and order that clearly is not at all well suited to the company of worses and children. On the other side of the door, the police and animal control have just broken into a flat where there's a lethal hound, only to discover the telling absence of the said hound. Elsa looks at the worse, looks at the monster.
"Why do you have the key to that flat?"
she asks the monster. The monster seems to start breathing more heavily.
"You left it in letter from Granny in envelope," he replies at long last, deep-throated.
Elsa tilts her head the other way.
"Did Granny write that you should take care of it?"
The monster nods reluctantly.
"Wrote, protect the castle."
Elsa nods. Their eyes meet, fleetingly. The monster looks a great deal as one does when wishing that people would just go home and filthify their own halls. Elsa looks at the worse.
"Why does it howl so much at night?"
The worse doesn't look as if it greatly appreciates being spoken of in the third person singular. That is, if it counts as a third person. The worse seems unsure about the grammatical rules of the case. The monster is getting tired of all the questions.
"Has grief," he says,
in a low voice towards the worse, rubbing his hands together although there is nothing left to rub in.
"Grief about what?"
asks Elsa. The monster's gaze is fixed on his palms.
"Grief About your grandmother.
Elsa looks at the Wurst. The Wurst looks at her, with black, sad eyes. Later, when she thinks about it, Elsa assumes this is when she really, really starts liking it a lot. She looks at the monster again.
Why did my granny send you a letter?
He rubs his hands harder.
Old friend, he mutters from behind his mountain of black hair.
What did it say?
Just said sorry, just sorry,
he says, disappearing even deeper into his hair and beard.
Why is my granny saying sorry to you?
She's starting to feel very much excluded from this story, and Elsa hates feeling excluded from stories.
Not matter for you, says the monster quietly.
She was my granny,
Elsa insists.
Was my sorry.
Elsa clenches her fists.
Touché,
she admits at last. The monster doesn't look up, just turns around and goes back into the bathroom. More running of water, more alcohol, more rubbing. The Wurst has picked up Elsa's backpack now with its teeth and has its whole snout inserted into it. It growls with great disappointment when it finds there is a palpable absence of chocolate-related materials in it. Elsa squints at the monster, her tone stricter and more interrogative.
When I gave you the letter, you spoke our secret language. You said, stupid girl. Was it Granny who taught you our secret language?
And then the monster looks up properly for the first time. His eyes open wide in surprise, and Elsa stares at him, her mouth agape.
Not she who taught me. I taught her,
says the monster in a low voice in the secret language. Now Elsa sounds out of breath.
You are...
And just at that moment, as she hears the police closing up the remains of the door to the Wurst's flat and walking out, while Britt Marie protests wildly, Elsa looks directly into the monster's eyes.
You are the werewolf boy!
And a breath later, she whispers in the secret language.
Your wolf heart.
And the monster nods, sadly. Chapter 11. Protein Bars. Granny's fairy tales from Miamis were fairly dramatic as a rule. Wars and storms and pursuits and intrigues and stuff, because these were the sorts of action stories that Granny liked. They were hardly ever about everyday life in the land of Almost Awake. So Elsa knows very little about how monsters and worses get along when they don't have armies to lead and shadows to fight. It turns out they don't really get along. It starts with the Wurst totally losing its patience with the monster, when the monster tries to wash the floor under the Wurst while the Wurst is still lying on it. And then, because the monster is extremely reluctant to touch the Wurst, he accidentally spatters some alcohol in its eye. Elsa has to intervene to stop a full-blown fight, and later when the monster, with extreme frustration, insists that Elsa must put one of those blue plastic bags on each of the Wurst's paws, the Wurst thinks it's gone far enough. In the end, once twilight is falling outside, and she's certain that the police are not still hanging about on the stairs, Elsa forces them both outside into the snow to give herself a bit of peace and quiet, to think over the situation and decide what to do next. She would have worried about being seen by Britt Marie from the balcony, except that it's 6 o'clock sharp, and Britt Marie and Kent have their dinner at exactly 6 o'clock, because only barbarians eat their dinner at any other time. Elsa nestles her chin into her Gryffindor scarf and tries to think clearly. The Wurst, still looking quite offended by the blue plastic bags, backs into a bush until only its nose is sticking out of the branches. It stays there, its eyes focused on Elsa with a very dissatisfied expression. It takes almost a minute before the monster sighs and makes a pointed gesture. Crapping, mumbles the monster and looks the other way.
Sorry,
says Elsa guiltily to the Wurst and turns away. They are using normal language again because something in Elsa's stomach
turns into a dark lump when she talks in the secret language to anyone but Granny. Either way, the monster doesn't seem too keen on any language. Meanwhile, the worst looks like you or I might if someone came barging in while you were attending to nature's needs, and it took a while before they understood how inappropriate it was to stand there gawking. Only then does Elsa realize that it actually can't have had a chance to relieve itself for several days, unless it did so inside its flat, which she rules out because she can't see how it could have maneuvered itself by using a toilet. And it certainly wouldn't have crapped on the floor, because this is not the sort of thing a worse would demean itself by doing. So she assumes that one of the worst's superpowers is clenching. She turns to the monster. He rubs his hands together and looks down at the tracks in the snow, as if he'd like to smooth out the snow with an iron.
"Are you a soldier?"
asks Elsa, pointing at his trousers. He shakes his head. Elsa continues pointing at his trousers because she's seen this type of trousers on the news.
"Those are soldier trousers."
The monster nods.
"Why are you wearing soldier's trousers if you're not a soldier, then?" she interrogates.
"Old trousers," the monster replies tersely.
"How did you get that scar?"
asks Elsa, pointing at his face.
"Accident,"
the monster replies, even more tersely.
"No shit, Sherlock. I wasn't implying you did it on purpose."
No shit, Sherlock is one of her favourite expressions in English. Her father always said one should not use English expressions if there are perfectly good substitutes in one's own language. But Elsa actually doesn't think there is a substitute in this case.
"Sorry, I didn't mean to sound rude. I just wanted to know what sort of accident."
"Normal accident,"
he growls, as if that settles matters. The monster disappears under the huge hood of his jacket.
"Late now. Should sleep."
She understands that he is alluding to her, not to himself. She points at the worse.
"That one has to sleep with you tonight."
The monster looks at her as if she's just asked him to get naked, roll in saliva, and then run through a postage stamp factory with the lights off. Or maybe not exactly like that, but more or less. He shakes his head so that his hood sways like a sail.
"Not sleep there, can't, not sleep there, can't, can't."
Elsa puts her hands on her stomach and glares at him.
"Where's it going to sleep then?"
The monster retracts deeper into his hood, points at Elsa. Elsa snorts.
"Mum didn't even let me get myself an owl. Do you get how she'd react if I came home with that thing?"
The worse comes out of the bushes making a lot of noise and looking offended. Elsa clears her throat and apologizes.
"Sorry, I didn't mean that thing in a bad sense."
The worse looks a bit as if it's close to muttering.
"Sure you didn't."
The monster rubs his hands in circles faster and faster and starts to look as if he's panicking and hisses down at the ground.
"Shit on fur has shit on fur, shit on fur."
Elsa rolls her eyes, realizing that if she presses the point, he'll probably have a heart attack. The monster turns away and looks as if he's trying to insert an invisible eraser into his brain to banish that image from his memory.
"What did Granny write in the letter?" she asks him.
The monster breathes grimly under his hood.
"Wrote, sorry," he says, without turning round.
"But what else? It was a really long letter."
The monster sighs and shakes his head and nods towards the entrance of the house.
"Late now. Sleep," he growls.
"Not until you tell me about the letter."
The monster looks like a very tired person being kept awake by someone thumping him at regular intervals as hard as he can with a pillowcase filled with yogurt. Or, more or less, anyway. He looks up and frowns and evaluates Elsa as if trying to work out how far he could fling her.
"Wrote, protect castle," he repeats.
Elsa steps closer to show that she's not afraid of him, or to show herself.
"And what else?"
He hunches up inside his hood and starts walking off through the snow.
"Protect you. Protect Elsa."
Then he disappears in the darkness and is gone. He disappears a lot, Elsa will learn in due course. He's surprisingly good at it for someone so large. Elsa hears muted panting from the other side of the yard and turns round. George comes jogging towards the house. She knows it's George because he's wearing shorts over his joggers and the greenest jacket in the world. He doesn't see her, and the worse, because he's too busy bouncing up and down from a bench. George trains a lot at running and jumping up and down from things. Elsa sometimes thinks he's in a permanent audition to be in the next Super Mario game.
Come,
whispers Elsa quickly to the worse to get it inside before George catches sight of it. And to her surprise, the mighty animal obeys her. The worse brushes past her legs, so its coat tickles her all the way up to her forehead, and she's almost knocked down by the force of it. She laughs. It looks at her and seems to be laughing as well. Apart from Granny, the worse is the first friend Elsa has ever had. She makes sure Britt-Marie is not prowling about on the stairs and that George still hasn't seen them, and then she leads the worse down into the cellar. The storage units are each assigned to a flat, and Granny's unit is unlocked and empty.
You have to stay here tonight, she whispers. Tomorrow we'll find you a better hiding place.
The worse doesn't look hugely impressed, but it lies down and rolls onto its side and peers nonchalantly into the parts of the cellar that still lie steeped in darkness. Elsa checks where it's looking, then focuses on the worse.
Granny always said there were ghosts down here, she says firmly. You mustn't scare them. Do you hear?
The worse lies unconcerned on its side on the floor, its mattock-sized incisors glinting through the darkness.
I'll bring more chocolate tomorrow, if you're nice, she promises.
The worse looks as if it's taking this concession into consideration. Elsa leans forward and kisses it on the nose. Then she darts up the stairs and closes the cellar door carefully behind her. She sneaks up without turning on the lights to minimize the risk of anyone seeing her. But when she comes to Britt-Marie in Kent's flat, she crouches and goes up the last flight in big leaps. She's almost sure that Britt-Marie is standing inside, peering out of the spy hole. The next morning, both the monster's flat and the cellar storage unit are dark and empty. George drives Elsa to school. Mum's already gone to the hospital because, as usual, there's some emergency going on there, and it's Mum's job to sort out emergencies. George talks about his protein bars the whole way. He bought a whole box of them, he says, and now he can't find them anywhere. George likes talking about protein bars and various functional items, functional clothes and functional jogging shoes, for example. George loves functions. Elsa hopes no one ever invents protein bars with functions because then George's head will probably explode. Not that Elsa would find that such a bad thing, but she imagines Mum would be upset about it, and there'd be an awful lot of cleaning. George drops her off in the parking area after asking her one more time if she's seen his missing protein bars. She groans with boredom and jumps out. The other children keep their distance, watching her guardedly. Rumours of the monster's intervention outside the park have spread, but Elsa knows it will only last a short while. It happened too far from school. Things that happen outside school may as well be happening in outer space, because she is protected in here anyway. She may have a respite of a couple of hours, but those who are chasing her will keep testing the boundaries, and once they drum up the courage to have another pop at her, they'll hit her harder than ever. And she knows that the monster will never get anywhere near the fence for her sake, because schools are full of children, and children are full of bacteria, and there's not enough Alka-Gel in the whole world for the monster after that. But she enjoys her freedom that morning in spite of all. It's the second to last day before the Christmas holidays, and after tomorrow she can have a couple of weeks of rest from running. A couple of weeks without notes in her locker about how ugly she is and how they're going to kill her. In the first break, she allows herself a walk along the fence. She tightens her backpack straps from time to time to make sure it isn't hanging too loose. She knows they won't be chasing her now, but it's a difficult habit to break. You run slower if your backpack's loose. Eventually, she lets herself drift off in her own thoughts. That is probably why she doesn't see it. She's thinking about Granny and Miamis. She wonders what plan Granny had in mind when she sent her out on this treasure hunt. That is, if she had any plan at all. Granny always sort of made her plans as she went along, and now she's no longer there, Elsa is having problems recognizing what the next step of the treasure hunt is supposed to be. Above all, she wonders what Granny meant when she said she was worried that Elsa would hate her when she found out more about her. Up until now, Elsa has only found out that Granny had some pretty dodgy friends, which was hardly a shock, you might say. And Elsa obviously understands that Granny's statement about who you were before you became a granny must have something to do with Elsa's mum, but she'd rather not ask mum unless she has to. Everything Elsa says to mum these days seems to end in an argument, and Elsa hates it. She hates that one can't be allowed to know things unless one starts arguing, and she hates being as alone as one can only be without Granny. So it must be for that reason that she doesn't notice it, because she's probably no more than 2 or 3 meters away when she finally sees it, which is an insane distance not to see a worse from. It's sitting by the gate, just outside the fence. She laughs, surprised. The worse seems to be laughing as well, but internally.
"I looked for you this morning," she says, and goes into the street, even though this is not allowed during breaks.
"Were you nice to the ghosts?" asks Elsa.
The worse doesn't look as if it was, but she throws her arms round its neck all the same, buries her hands deep in its thick black fur, and exclaims,
"Wait, I've got something for you."
The worse greedily sticks its nose into her backpack, but looks remarkably disappointed when it pulls it back out again.
"They're protein bars," says Elsa, apologetically. "We don't have any sweets at home because Mum doesn't want me to eat them, but George says these are mega tasty."
The worse doesn't like them at all. It only has about 9 of them. When the bell goes, Elsa hugs it hard, hard, hard one more time and whispers,
"Thanks for coming."
She knows that the other children in the playground see her do it. The teachers may be able to avoid noticing the biggest, blackest, worse appearing out of nowhere in the morning break, but no child in the entire universe could. No one leaves any notes in Elsa's locker that day. Chapter 12. Mint. Elsa stands alone on the balcony of Granny's flat. They used to stand here often. It was here that Granny first pointed at the cloud animals and talked about the land of almost awake, just after Mum and Dad got divorced. That night, Elsa got to see Miamis for the first time. She stares out blindly into the darkness and misses her more than ever. She's been lying on Granny's bed, looking up at the photos on the ceiling and trying to figure out what Granny was talking about at the hospital when she said, "Elsa mustn't hate her." And also, "It's a grandmother's privilege never to have to show her grandchild who she was before she became a grandmother." Elsa has spent hours trying to work out what this treasure hunt is for, or where the next clue can be found, if there even is one. The worse sleeps in the storage unit in the cellar. In the midst of all this, it's good to know that the worse is close at hand. It makes Elsa feel a little bit less lonely. She peers over the balcony railing, has a sense of something moving down there on the ground in the darkness. She can't see anything, obviously, but she knows the monster is there. Granny has planned the fairy tale in this way. The monster is guarding the castle, guarding Elsa. She's just angry with Granny for never explaining what he's guarding it from. A voice further off soars through the silence.
Yeah, I've got all the booze for the party. I'm only just getting back home now,"
the voice declares irritably as it draws closer. It's the woman in the black skirt, talking into the white lead. She's heaving 4 heavy plastic bags along, and they knock into each other and then against her shins at every step. The woman swears and fumbles with her keys by the door.
"Oh, there'll be at least 20 of us, and you know how well the guys in the office hold their drink. Not that they had any time to help, mind you, isn't it? I know, as if I didn't have a full-time job as well."
Is the last thing Elsa hears before the woman marches into the house. Elsa doesn't know much at all about the woman in the black skirt, except that everything smells of mint, and she always has very well-ironed clothes, and always seems to be stressed out. Granny used to say it was because of her boys. Elsa doesn't know what that's supposed to mean, Inside, Mum is sitting on a high stool in the kitchen, talking on the telephone and fiddling restlessly with one of Granny's tea towels. She never seems to have to listen very much to what the person at the other end of the line is saying. No one ever disagrees with Mum. Not that she raises her voice or interrupts. She's just not the sort of person anyone wants to get on the wrong side of. Mum likes to keep it like this because conflict is bad for efficiency, and efficiency is very important to her. George sometimes jokes that Mum will give birth to Harvey in her lunch break to avoid any negative effect on the hospital's general efficiency. Elsa hates George for making all those stupid jokes. Hates him because he thinks he knows Mum well enough to make jokes about her. Of course, Granny thought efficiency was rubbish, and she couldn't give a crap about the negative effect of conflict. Elsa heard one of the doctors at Mum's hospital saying that Granny could start a fight in an empty room. But when Elsa told Granny, she just looked miffed and said, "What if it was the room that started it?" And then she told the fairy tale about the girl who said no, even though Elsa had already heard it at least an eternity of times. The girl who said no was one of the first stories Elsa ever heard from the land of Almost Awake. It was about the Queen of Miodacus, one of the six kingdoms. In the beginning, the queen had been a courageous and fair-minded princess, very much liked by all. But unfortunately, she grew up and became a frightened adult, as adults tend to be. She started loving efficiency and avoiding conflict, as adults do. And then, the queen simply forbade all conflict in Miodacus. Everyone had to get along the whole time. And because nearly all conflicts start with someone saying no, the queen also made this word illegal. Anyone breaking this law was immediately cast into a huge naysayers' prison, and hundreds of soldiers in black armour, who were known as yaysayers, patrolled the streets to make sure there were no disagreements anywhere. Dissatisfied with this, the queen had soon outlawed not only the word no, but also other words, including not, and maybe, and perhaps. Any of these were enough to get you sent straight to prison, where you'd never again see the light of day. After a couple of years, words like possibly and if and wait and see had also been made illegal. In the end, no one dared say anything at all. And then the Queen felt that she might as well make all talking illegal because almost every conflict tended to start with someone saying something. And after that, there was silence in the kingdom for several years. Until one day a little girl came riding in, singing as she went, and everyone stared at her because singing was an extremely serious crime in Miodacus, because there was a risk of one person liking the song and another disliking it. The yaysayers sprang into action to stop the girl, but they couldn't catch her because she was very good at running. So the yaysayers rang all the bells and called for reinforcements, upon which the Queen's very own elite force, known as the Paragraph Riders, because they rode a very special kind of animal that was a cross between a giraffe and a rule book, came out to stop the girl. But not even the Paragraph Riders could lay their hands on her. And in the end, the Queen in person came rushing out of her castle and roared at the girl to stop singing. But then the girl turned to the Queen, stared her right in the eye and said, "No." And as soon as she had said it, a piece of masonry fell off the wall round the prison. And when the girl said, "No," one more time, another piece of masonry fell. And before long, not only the girl, but all the other people in the kingdom, even the yaysayers and the paragraph riders, were shouting, "No, no, no!" And then the prison crumbled. And that was how the people of Miodacus learned that a queen only stays in power for as long as her subjects are afraid of conflict. Or at least Elsa thinks that was the moral of the story. She knows this partly because she checked out moral on Wikipedia, and partly because the very first word Elsa learned to say was no, which led to a lot of arguing between Mum and Granny. They fought about a lot of other things as well, of course. Once Granny said to Elsa's Mum that she only became a manager as a way of expressing teenage rebellion, because the very worst rebellion Elsa's mum could dream up was to become an economist. Elsa never really understood what was meant by that. But later that night, when they thought Elsa was sleeping, Elsa heard Mum rebuff Granny by saying, "What do you know about my teenage years? You were never here." That was the only time Elsa ever heard Mum saying anything to Granny while holding back the tears. And then Granny went very quiet and never repeated the comment about teenage rebellion to Elsa. Mum finishes her call and stands in the middle of the kitchen floor with the tea towel in her hand, looking as if she's forgotten something. She looks at Elsa. Elsa looks back dubiously. Mum smiles sadly. "Do you want to help me pack some of your granny's things into boxes?" Elsa nods, even though she doesn't want to. Mum insists on packing boxes every night, despite being told by both the doctor and George that she should be taking it easy. Mum isn't very good at either, taking it easy or being told. "Your dad is coming to pick you up from school tomorrow afternoon," says Mum in passing as she ticks things off on her Excel packing spreadsheet.
"Because you're working late?"
asks Elsa, as if she means nothing in particular by the question.
"I'll be, staying on for a while at the hospital," says Mum, because she doesn't like lying to Elsa. "Can't George pick me up then?"
"George is coming with me to the hospital." Elsa packs things haphazardly into the box, deliberately ignoring the spreadsheet.
"Is Harfy sick?"
Mum tries to smile again. It doesn't go so very well.
"Don't worry, darling." "That's the quickest way for me to know that I should be mega worrying," answers Elsa.
"It's complicated," Mum sighs.
"Everything is complicated if no one explains it to you."
"It's just a routine checkup."
"No, it isn't. No one has so many routine checkups in a pregnancy. I'm not that stupid."
Mum massages her temples and looks away. "Please, Elsa, don't you start making trouble about this as well."
"What do you mean, as well? What else have I been making trouble with you about?"
Elsa hisses, as one does when one is almost 8 and feels slightly put upon.
"Don't shout," says Mum, in a composed voice. "I'm not shouting,"
shouts Elsa. And then they both look down at the floor for a long time, looking for their own ways of saying sorry. Neither of them knows where to begin. Elsa thumps down the lid of the removal crate, stomps off into Granny's bedroom, and slams the door. You could hear a pin drop in the flat for about 30 minutes after that, because that is how angry Elsa is. So angry that she has to start measuring time in minutes rather than eternities. She lies on Granny's bed and stares at the black and white photos on the ceiling. The werewolf boy seems to be waving at her and laughing. Deep inside, she wonders how anyone who laughs like that can grow up into something as incredibly doleful as the monster. She hears the doorbell go, and then a second ring following incredibly fast, much faster than would be feasible for a normal person when ringing a doorbell, so it can only be Britt Marie. "I'm coming," Mum answers politely. Elsa can tell by her voice that she's been crying. The words come flowing out of Britt Marie as if she's fitted with a wind-up mechanism and someone has cranked it up using a key on her back.
"I rang your door. No one opened,"
Mum sighs. "No, we're not home. We're here."
"Your mother's car is parked in the garage and that hound is still loose on the property?"
She's talking so quickly it's clear she can't prioritize her various upsets. Elsa sits up in Granny's bed, but it takes almost a minute before she manages to take in what Britt Marie just said. Then she bounces out of bed and has to muster all her self-control to stop herself dashing off down the hall because she doesn't want to make the old busybody suspicious. Britt Marie stands on the landing with one hand very firmly inserted into the other, smiling at Mum in a well-meaning way, nattering on about how in this leaseholders' association they can't have rabid dogs running around.
A sanitary nuisance is what it is."
"The dog is probably far away by now, Britt Marie. I wouldn't worry about it." Britt Marie turns to Mum and smiles well-meaningly.
"No, no, of course you wouldn't, Ulrika, of course you wouldn't. You're not the type to worry yourself about other people's safety, even your own child's, are you? It's something you've inherited, I see, putting the career before the children. That is how it's always been in your family."
Mum's face is utterly relaxed. Her arms hang down, apparently relaxed. The only thing that gives her away is that she's slowly, slowly clenching her fists. Elsa has never seen her do that before. Britt Marie also notices. Again, she switches the position of her hands on her stomach. Looks as if she's sweating. Her smile stiffens.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, Ulrika, obviously. Obviously not. You make your own choices and prioritizations, obviously.
Was there anything else on your mind? Says Mum slowly. But something in her eyes has changed hue, which makes Britt Marie take a small, small step back.
No, no, nothing else. Nothing else at all.
Elsa sticks out her head before she has time to turn round and leave.
What was that you said about Granny's car? It's in the garage,
she says curtly, avoiding Mum's eye.
It's parked in my space, and if it isn't moved at once, I'll call the police. How did it get there? How am I supposed to know?
Then she turns to Elsa's mum again with renewed courage.
The car has to be moved at once, otherwise I'm calling the police, Ulrika.
I don't know where the car keys are, Britt Marie. And if you don't mind, I need to sit down. I seem to be getting a headache.
Maybe if you didn't drink so much coffee, you wouldn't get headaches so often, Ulrika.
She turns round and stomps down the stairs so quickly no one has time to answer her. Mum closes the door in a slightly less self-controlled and composed way than usual and heads into the kitchen.
What did she mean by that?
Asks Elsa. She doesn't think I should drink coffee when I'm pregnant, Mum replies. Her phone starts ringing.
That's not what I meant,
says Elsa. She hates it when Mum pretends to be stupid. Mum picks up her telephone from the kitchen counter. I have to answer this, sweetheart.
What did Britt Marie mean when she said in our family we put the career before the children? She meant Granny, didn't she?
The telephone continues ringing. It's from the hospital. I have to answer.
No, you don't.
They stand in silence, looking at each other while the telephone rings two more times. Now it's Elsa's turn to clench her fists. Mum's fingers steal across the display. I have to take this, Elsa.
No, you don't.
Mum closes her eyes and answers the telephone. By the time she starts talking into it, Elsa has already slammed the door to Granny's bedroom behind her. When Mum gently opens the door half an hour later, Elsa pretends to be asleep. Mum sneaks up and tucks her in, kisses her cheek, turns off the lamp. By the time Elsa gets up an hour after that, Mum is sleeping on the sofa in the living room. Elsa sneaks up and tucks her and Halfie in, kisses Mum on the cheek, turns out the lamp. Mum is still holding Granny's tea towel in her hand. Elsa fetches a torch from one of the boxes in the hall and puts on her shoes, because now she knows where to find the next clue in Granny's treasure hunt. Chapter 13. Wine. It's a bit tricky to explain, but some things in Granny's fairy tales are like that. You have to understand, first of all, that no creature in the land of Almost Awake is sadder than the sea angel, and it's actually only once Elsa remembers this whole story that Granny's treasure hunt begins to make sense. Elsa's birthday was always extremely important to Granny, maybe because Elsa's birthday is 2 days after Christmas, and Christmas is very important to everyone else, and as a result, no child with a birthday 2 days after Christmas ever gets quite the same amount of attention as a child born in August or April. So Granny had a tendency to overcompensate. Mum had banned her from planning surprise parties after that time Granny let off fireworks inside a hamburger restaurant and accidentally set fire to a 17-year-old girl who was dressed up as a clown and apparently supposed to be providing entertainment for the children. She really was entertaining, Elsa should say in her defence. That day, Elsa learned some of her very best swear words. The thing is, in Miamis, you don't get presents on your birthday. You give presents, preferably something you have at home and are very fond of, which you then give to someone you like even more. That's why everyone in Miamis looks forward to other people's birthdays, and that's the origin of the expression, what do you get from someone who has everything? When the enfants took this fairy tale into the real world, someone here managed to get the wrong end of the stick, of course, making it, what do you give to someone who has everything? But what else would you expect? These are the same Muppets who managed to misinterpret the word interpret, which means something completely different in Miamis. In Miamis, an interpreter is a creature most easily described as a combination between a goat and a chocolate biscuit. Interpreters are extremely gifted linguistically, as well as excellent to grill on the barbecue. At least they were until Elsa became a vegetarian, after which Granny was not allowed to mention them anymore. Anyway, so Elsa was born 2 days after Christmas, almost 8 years ago, the same day that the scientists registered the gamma radiation from that magnetar. The other thing that happened that day was a tsunami in the Indian Ocean. Elsa knows that this is a sickeningly big wave caused by an earthquake, except sort of at sea, so more like an ocean quake, really, if you want to be pernickety about it. And Elsa is quite pernickety. 200,000 people died at the same time as Elsa started to live. Sometimes when Elsa's mum thinks Elsa can't hear, she tells George she still feels guilty. It cuts her to the quick to think that this was the happiest day of her life. Elsa was 5 and about to turn 6 when she read about it online for the first time. On her 6th birthday, Granny told her the story of the sea angel, to teach her that not all monsters are monsters in the beginning, and not all monsters look like monsters. Some carry their monstrosity inside. The very last thing the shadows did before the ending of the war without end was to destroy all of Mibatalos, the kingdom where all the warriors had been brought up. But then came Wolfheart and the Worsers, and everything turned, and when the shadows fled the land of Almost Awake, they charged out over the sea with terrible force from all the coastlines of the 6 kingdoms. And their imprint on the surface of the water stirred up hideous waves, which, one by one, smashed into each other until they had formed a single wave as high as the eternity of 10,000 fairy tales. And to stop anyone pursuing the shadows, the wave turned and threw itself back in towards land. It could have crushed the whole land of Almost Awake. It could have broken over the land and decimated the castle and the houses and all those who lived in them far more terribly than all the armies of the shadows could have managed through all eternity. That was when 100 snow angels saved the remaining 5 kingdoms. Because while everyone else was running from the wave, the snow angels rushed right into it. With their wings open, and the power of all their epic stories in their hearts, they formed a magical wall against the water and stopped it coming in. Not even a wave created by shadows could get past 100 snow angels prepared to die so that a whole world of fairy tales could live. Only one of them turned back from the massive body of water. And even if Granny always said that those snow angels were arrogant sods who sniffed at wine and made a right carry-on, she never tried to take away from them the heroism they showed on that day. For the day when the war without end came to an end was the happiest day ever for everyone in the land of Almost Awake, apart from the 100th snow angel. Since then, the angel had drifted up and down the coast, weighed down by a curse that prevented it from leaving the place that had taken away all those it loved. It did this for so long that the people in the villages along the coast forgot who it used to be and started calling it the Sea Angel instead. And as the years went by, the angel was buried deeper and deeper in an avalanche of sorrow until its heart split in two, and then its whole body split like a shattered mirror. When the children from the villages sneaked down to the coast to catch a glimpse of it, one moment they might see a face of such beauty it took their breath away, but in the next they would see something so terrible and deformed and wild looking back at them that they would run screaming all the way home. Because not all monsters were monsters in the beginning. Some are monsters born of sorrow. According to one of the most often told stories in the land of Almost Awake, it was a small child from Miamis who managed to break the curse on the sea angel, releasing it from the demons of memory that held it captive. When Granny told Elsa that story for the first time on her 6th birthday, Elsa realized she was no longer a child. So she gave Granny her cuddly toy lion as a present, because Elsa didn't need it anymore, she realized, and wanted it to protect her Granny instead. And that night, Granny whispered into Elsa's ear that if they were ever parted, if Granny ever got lost, she would send the lion to go and tell Elsa where she was. It had taken Elsa a few days to work it out. Only tonight, when Britt Marie mentioned that Renault had suddenly been parked in the garage without anyone knowing how it got there, did Elsa remember where Granny had put the lion on guard. The glove compartment, in Renault. That was where Granny kept her cigarettes, and nothing in Granny's life needed a lion guarding it more than that. So Elsa sits in the passenger seat in Renault and inhales deeply. As usual, Renault's doors weren't locked, because Granny never locked anything, and he still smells of smoke. Elsa knows it's bad, but because it's Granny's smoke, she takes deep breaths of it anyway. "I miss you," she whispers into the upholstery of the backrest. Then she opens the glove compartment, moves the lion aside, and takes out the letter. On it is written, "For Miami's bravest knight, to be delivered to," and then scrawled in Granny's awful handwriting, a name and an address. Later that night, Elsa sits on the top step outside Granny's flat until the ceiling lights switch themselves off, runs her finger over Granny's writing on the envelope again and again, but doesn't open it, just puts it in her backpack and stretches out on the cold floor, and mostly keeps her eyes closed. Tries one more time to get off to Miami's. She lies there for hours without succeeding, stays there until she hears the main door at the bottom of the house opening and closing again. She lies on the floor and mostly keeps her eyes closed until she feels the night embracing the windows of the house and hears the drunk start rattling around with something a few floors further down. Elsa's mum doesn't like it when she calls the drunk the drunk.
"What do I call her, then?"
Elsa used to ask, and then Mum used to look very unsure and sound a bit smarmy while managing to suggest something like,
It's someone who's tired.
And then Granny used to chip in.
"Tired? Hell, yeah, of course you get tired when you're up boozing all night."
And then Mum used to yell,
"Mum!"
And then Granny used to throw out her hands and ask,
"Oh, good God, what did I say wrong now, then?"
And then it was time for Elsa to put on her headphones.
"Turn off the water," I said. "No bathing at night,"
the drunk stammers from below at no one in particular, whacking her shoehorn against the banister. That's what the drunk always does, roars and screams and bashes things with that shoehorn, then sings that same old song of hers. Of course, no one ever comes out and quietens her down, not even Britt Marie. For in this house, drunks are like monsters. People think if they ignore them, they'll cease to exist. Elsa sits up into a squatting position and peers down through the gap between the stairs. She can only make out a glimpse of the drunk's socks as she shambles past, swinging the shoehorn as if scything tall grass. Elsa can't quite explain to herself why she does it, but she heaves herself up on her tiptoes and sneaks down the first flight of stairs. Out of pure curiosity, perhaps. Or perhaps more likely, because she is bored and frustrated about no longer being able to get to Miami's. The door of the drunk's flat is open. There's a faint light cast by an overturned floor lamp. Photos on all the walls. Elsa has never seen so many photos. She thought Granny had a lot of them on her ceiling, but these must be in their thousands. Each of them is framed in a small white wooden frame, and all are of two teenage boys and a man who must be their father. In one of the photos, the man and the boys are standing on a beach with a sparkling green sea behind them. The boys are both wearing wetsuits. They smile. They are bronzed. They look happy. Under the frame is one of those cheap congratulatory cards, the kind you buy in a petrol station when you've forgotten to get a proper card. To Mum, from your boys, it says on the front. Beside the card hangs a mirror. Shattered. The words reverberating over the landing are so sudden and so filled with fury that Elsa loses her balance and slips down the bottom 4 or 5 steps, right into the wall.
What are you doing here?
Elsa peers up through the railings at the deranged person wielding the shoehorn at her, looking simultaneously incandescent and terrified. Her eyes flicker. That black skirt is full of creases now. She smells of wine. Elsa can feel it all the way from the floor below. Her hair looks like a bundle of string in which 2 birds have got themselves tangled up during a fight. She has purple bags under her eyes. The woman sways. She probably means to yell, but it comes out as a wheeze.
You are not allowed to bathe at night. The water, turn off the water, everyone will drown.
The white cable she always talks into sits in her ear, but the other end just dangles against her hip, disconnected. Elsa realizes there has probably never been anyone there, and that's not an easy thing for an almost 8-year-old to understand. Granny told many fairy tales about many things, but never about women in black skirts pretending to have telephone conversations while they went up the stairs, so their neighbors wouldn't think they'd bought all that wine for themselves. The woman looks confused, as if she has suddenly forgotten where she is. She disappears, and in the next moment, Elsa feels her mum gently plucking her from the stairs, feels her warm breath against her neck and her in her ear, as if they were standing in front of a roe deer and had got a bit too close. Elsa opens her mouth, but Mum puts her finger over her lips.
Shush,
whispers Mum again and keeps her arms tight round her. Elsa curls up in her arms in the dark, and they see the woman in the black skirt drifting back and forth down there like a flag that's torn itself free in the wind. Plastic bags lie scattered on the floor of her flat. One of the wine boxes has toppled over. A few last drops of red are dripping onto the parquet floor. Mum makes a gentle movement against Elsa's hand. They stand up quietly and go back up the stairs. And that night Elsa's mum tells Elsa what everyone except Elsa's parents were talking about on the day Elsa was born. About a wave that broke over a beach 10,000 kilometers away and crushed everything in its path. About 2 boys who swam out after their father and never came back. Elsa hears how the drunk starts singing her song, because not all monsters look like monsters. There are some that carry their monstrosity inside. Chapter 14. Tires. So many hearts broke the day Elsa was born. Shattered with such force by the wave that the shards of glass were dispersed all round the world. Improbable catastrophes produce improbable things in people, improbable sorrow and improbable heroism. More death than human senses can comprehend. 2 boys carrying their mother to safety and then turning back for their father, because a family does not leave anyone behind. And yet in the end, that is precisely what they did, her boys, left her alone. Elsa's granny lived in another rhythm from other people. She operated in a different way. In the real world, in relation to everything that functioned, she was chaotic. But when the real world crumbles, when everything turns into chaos, then people like Elsa's granny can sometimes be the only ones who stay functional. That was another of her superpowers. When Granny was headed for some far-off place, you could only be sure of one thing, that it was a place everyone else was trying to get away from. And if anyone asked her why she was doing it, she'd answer, "I'm a doctor, for God's sake, and ever since I became one, I've not allowed myself the luxury of choosing whose life I should be saving." She wasn't big on efficiency and economics, Granny, but everyone listened to her when there was chaos. The other doctors wouldn't be seen dead with her on a good day. But when the world collapsed into pieces, they followed her like an army. Because improbable tragedies create improbable superheroes. Once, late one night, when they were on their way to Miamis, Elsa had asked Granny about it, about how it felt to be somewhere when the world crumbles, and how it was being in the land of Almost Awake during the war without end, and what it was like when they saw that wave breaking over the 99 snow angels. And Granny had answered, "It's like the very worst thing you could dream up, worked out by the